All right, this is an interview with Julian Fesich for the Youngstown State University World War II Project by Stephen R. Ard at 3471 Schotten Road, Hubbard, Ohio, on the 19th of June at approximately 9:35 a.m. There we go. Okay, do you want to tell me when you were born and where?
I was born right here in Hubbard, right in this house, and on January 1st, 1925. And I grew up here, and the only time I left this area, home here, is when I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents farm?
Yes, they had a dairy farm. And my dad sold his dairy cattle in 1955, and we still farm, and I do, and I raise beef cattle, Hereford, white-faced beef. That's what I'm doing now. And besides doing that, this farming, I work at United States Steel in Higher Works as a stationary engineer in the boiler house.
Did you go to school here in Hubbard?
Yes.
Did
graduated from Hubbard High School in 1942.
Yeah. Can you recall some of your boyhood here on the farm?
Oh, it was very wonderful. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We didn't have electricity out here, just like the Amish.
Uh-huh.
We worked with horses. And haying time in the summer was hard. All the kids had summer vacation, you know, from school if they didn't know it. We did everything the hard way. And we had to put the hay on the wagon by hand and unload it with the harpoon hook, spread it in the mow. And then we had our good times. We had the swimming pool down on the creek.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go down there every day and swimming. We had fish down there. And we'd hike through the woods, and we'd walk all the way in the Hubbard to see a movie. Sometimes they'd have a good movie like Mutiny on the Bounty, and Captain Blood, or something like that. Prince and the Pauper, those even scary ones like Frankenstein, you know, Dracula. We'd walk in. There were 10 cents then to see the movie. It was 10 cents. And we usually take 15 cents nickel for an ice cream cone on the way home. One time our dog went in a movie theater with us. He got thrown out.
Do you remember anything from the Depression era?
Oh, very, very little. I was just a little boy, but I remember almost every day there were people that walked up and down the road here. They usually had a little case or a little gunny sack. Men. And they would stop and ask for something to eat. And my mother always gave them something. And sometimes they'd offer to do some work like splitting firewood or something. And, but very seldom that they would they work. And they get their food and then they'd be off on their way. And I'd never see them again.
Now, were these people from around this area, or just passing through?
They always knew that they were hungry, of course, and it was numerous. Because in the summertime, especially, you'd see every day somebody walking along the road, and he'd stop. You know, our house was right by the road there. He'd stop, and he'd ask for something to eat. So he got something to eat. He'd be on his way. See him again. But that's what I can remember about the Depression.
All right, you graduated in 1942, so the war had been going on. Did you volunteer or were you drafted?
No, I was drafted. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was drafted in January of 1944.
What were you doing up until that time?
Oh, I was going down to the university there for a semester.
Yeah, that's nice.
For a semester, and then I got the notice to go into the Army and so I dropped out for that. Well, it's only one month, last semester. And then I was farming here, helping my dad on the farm. And I was just biding my time because I knew I was going to have to go. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was supposed to go earlier the following summer. And my brother went in May, and I was supposed to go in June. And my dad, he wanted to get his hay in for the winter in the barn. So he went up to the, they had the draft board, and he got me deferred for a few months. And it didn't last more than I thought it would. It lasted for till January. Because then he wouldn't have had anybody home to help him with his pain. So they granted that to me temporarily until it crops in.
Where'd you do your training at?
Down in Mississippi, Camp Van Dorn and Camp McCain. I got down in Camp Van Dorn of Camp McCain, the first camp. I went into Fort Hays, Columbus. In fact, I helped close the place up. That was the last inductee. I was with the last group of inductees that went through Fort Hays. And we helped close the place up, pulling up things away. And then we went down.
Do you know why the camp was being closed down?
No, I don't. They just, they had it all through the years. World War II. And of course, it was World War I, too. And it was a very famous induction camp. But why they closed it down just when I got there, I don't know. Whether they, I don't know, maybe their volume of inductees weren't as high. Went down to Camp McCain with the 94th Infantry Division. They put me right into a rifle company, the regular division. There was no basic training. And they put me right in with the regular division. And I trained with them. Although there were others that went in with me, and they gave us a little bit of basic training to go along, separate from what the others were getting, the more advanced training. But I only stayed there for was 2 months. And the division was slated to go overseas with General Patton's army. And they were overstrength, and luckily for me, the sergeant was from Youngstown. His name was Fulweiler. And he put me on a shipping list to go out. So I went down to the other camp in Mississippi, Camp Van Dorn. And it was the 63rd Infantry Division. And we had basic training down there, and we trained throughout the area of their camp. We had training camp there. Rifle range and all the ways of infantry fighting and all that. Mm-hmm. And the hikes, and some of it's boring. And
did you have time to go on any war problems in terms of training exercises?
Oh yeah, you had your squad tactics and platoon tactics, and you went to battalion and regimental, regiment, yeah. War games, they called them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, for these war games, did you have actual rifles?
Yeah, but they were blanks. We used blanks. Mm-hmm. You know, just pretend. It was all pretend. But the only, you actually shot the ammunition at the rifle range, and you threw grenades, live grenades, and the bazooka, you fire that. That was live ammunition, and mortar shells, and fire them live, and machine guns. Yeah, yeah. But when you're actually, one was against the other in training like that, well, you didn't dare do that because you would kill somebody. You had to do this out on a firing range where everything was protected. And there were security around. You had guards out to watch that nobody would trespass and get hurt.
Yeah. All right, then from where did you go then?
Well, there we went to Camp Shanks, New York,
on a troop train and got on a ship, and troop ship, and I was in with a 20,000 soldiers that went over on a convoy on different ships, and then they, of course they had supply ships with the Navy, and four overseas for the Army, but the Navy escorted us, destroyer escorts and the blimps, and we went into Marseille, France, through the Gibraltar, of course, and from Marseille, we went on a staging area up at the mountain there, overlooking Marseille, and I would say that was the coldest night I ever spent in my life, and I don't think I could ever even on the South Pole that you would spend a colder night than that mountain. And the wind, it was December, and the winds were whipping out of the ocean in the Mediterranean. They must have been going 60 miles an hour, and we just froze. We froze, and I was never so happy to get out of there. I think we spent one night there, or two nights. They went on these 48, the French 48 boxcars, they were famous for World War I, and you hold 40 men or 8 horses, whichever you want. And we had about 30 men. They put about 30 soldiers in each car. Then we went up along France, up along the Rhone River, through Arles, where Vincent van Gogh did a lot of his painting, and in the Lyons. Lyon is a silk center of France. And this was all liberated country already. And I went in the Alsace-Lorraine, over by Haguenau, and Sarrebourg. Sargemine. We got detrained at Sarrebourg, and we went up one truck partway, and then we had to walk the rest of the way. Then we went up online at Sargemund, which is by Saarbrücken, the biggest city, and Saarbrücken was one of the most heavily fortified places in the Siegfried Line, along with Metz, and General Patton had taken Metz after 6 weeks. And he thought he could take Saarbrücken also, but it wasn't so. And but he was assaulting at that time. He was assaulting Saarbrücken, and the 7th Army that I was in was right on the extreme right of Patton's. In fact, at times my company was right shoulder to shoulder with the Patton's 70th Infantry Division that was attacking Saarbrücken. Well. That was a few months later that this was going on, where I was right against the Patton's army. But at that time when we got up online, it was sort of quiet there. The Germans weren't attacking us too much, and so I broke in easily, which is a good thing. And then the Battle of Bulge took place. And they pulled 25 men out of every company right away. And they trucked them up as replacements for the infantry units up in the Bulge area. But I want to tell you about the infantry now. I was in a rifle company, and you have 3 platoons of riflemen, and you have a weapons platoon. The weapons platoon is you have 2 machine guns and 3 mortars, 60-millimeter mortars. And I was in the weapons platoon, and I was on machine gun and mortars. Most of the time I was mortar man. I was a gunner. I would fire the mortar and aimed it, fired it at a little sight to fit on there, and leveled the bubbles. And I got pretty proficient at it. I could drop a shot right in the German foxhole at a moderate range. But of course, at a great distance, why the accuracy would drop. So they would fire, a mile at least. And I could lob a mortar shell a mile, and you could follow the trajectory up in here. You could follow it all the way. Same thing with artillery shells. You could see them flying, coming through the air, and overhead. You could follow them all the way. But anyhow, and they had three rifle platoons. And that is your line. You know, we lived into foxholes. We dug foxholes. And the riflemen are always up there with the machine gunner spaced, you know, two machine guns spaced wherever they needed them the best. And then every rifle squad had a BAR man, which is a Browning automatic rifle. It's like a machine gun, only it used a magazine clip instead of a belt. And I didn't like it because it was a very bulky rifle. It weighed a lot of pounds, I think about 22 pounds with the magazine. And the soldier carried this big cartridge belt filled with these magazines. And he was weighed down heavily. And they just never could see being burdened like that. And it was even bad to run, let alone walk.
What was his function?
Well, he was a support for the rifleman. If the machine gunner couldn't give him fast firing immediately, and he would take over those duties. But it wasn't an accurate gun when you fired it fast. If you fired single shot, why, it was just like a rifle. But if you try to hold it, you hold the trigger down, it would fire automatically, but it wasn't that accurate. Although some claimed they could shoot it accurately, but I disagreed with them. But it was invented by Browning, who invented a lot of our army. I think the pistol, 45 pistol.
Okay, where'd you go from there then?
Well, we stayed static for maybe 10 days until the events turned at the Bulge, and then we had orders to start attacking the Germans.
Now, is that the first time, more or less, you're going into combat?
This is the first time I experienced actual combat. At other times, I was on the front, but it was static. The Germans did not attack us, and we did not attack them, and there was nothing but no man's land in between. And I would go out on outpost duty on, like, the nighttime. We did outpost duty on a machine gun out there, no man's land, and had a little telephone and that you could whisper in to call for supporting fire, like for mortar fire or artillery fire, and if you saw Germans creeping up. And that was the idea. He went out there, and he'd go out there, and he'd hear the cats crying. Well, right away, you know, it's Germans. They're tough, and they're sneaking up, crawling, and they're signaling to each other that way. You hear, meow. And so I get on a telephone, and Germans, and set up white phosphorus. And we'd had the mortars back there when I was on a machine gun, or if I was back on a mortar, I would fire them. This would happen repeatedly at night. And we fired a white phosphorus mortar shells, and the Germans were deadly afraid of white phosphorus because it's sprayed, and when it hit your skin, it would burn a hole right through your skin to your bone, and you would get scarred for life, and you wouldn't want to get it on your face because it would scar your face. So anytime we fired those white phosphorus shells, any Germans around would run. They would get up and run as fast as they could go. And so we'd lay down a pattern, kind of call for mortar fire, usually. Very seldom call for artillery fire, unless you could, first you'd call for a flare. You'd call for a flare, a mortar flare, and they'd fire it up in the air, and you could see the Germans. Usually see them lying down on the ground in a pattern, and then nearby too, and you call for white phosphorus right away, and they put down a pattern, usually about maybe 9 rounds or sometimes 27 rounds or 21, anyhow up to two or three dozen, and spread them in a pattern, and after the first one hit, the Germans would usually start tailing, go right back, but it was a sort of a static front. Then we had orders to attack, and we did. We moved down on the Germans, and they were in a trench at the edge of a small airport in a wooded area. They were in the wooded area, and they had steel concrete bunkers and by their trenches that they stayed in, and that's why our artillery never eliminated them, because they had good, strong entrenchments there. And so the riflemen would do the attacking into the trenches, and I remember throwing mortar shells in. Two of us were throwing mortar shells, firing the mortars, and we must have fired 200 shells in a half an hour in those trenches and the wooded area where the Germans were in foxholes. That firefight lasted about a half an hour, I think. And we drove the Germans out across the Saar River. It was down over the hill into Germany. And we were right at the Saar River there, Sarga mines. And, but it was still called Alsace. But the other side is Saar is Germany. All right. We drove them down. They went across the Saar River into the wooded area. And we moved into the point of woods, and we knew in the army that any time we attack the Germans, they always counterattack before night, before it gets dark, at dusk. They always counterattack, and why they had that idea embedded in them, I don't know, but it was a disaster for them. So we moved into the point of woods there, and we dug in, and we just waited for dusk to come around and for their counterattack. So we have the big, this was the first actual push that we had in our area. So everybody was active, you know, and alive. And we're waiting, and here they come. They're coming out of the woods. And there's a whole battalion of Germans, 800 of them, they're coming at us. They're coming out of the wooded area into the open fields and down to the Saar River, and getting ready to cross the Saar River, wade across, swim across, and come up at us. But here comes our artillery, all the way back to Corps artillery. 240. You got 155 long toms, then you got 155s, then you got 105, you got cannon company. And we were using the proximity fuse that bursts in the air, and they also had the time fire, and First Corps would fire, and the 155 top would fire a few seconds later, and all these shells would merge it, come at once. And you could see them in the air, like crows, and dark in the sky, without the sun, and hundreds of them coming. And it seemed like, well, probably around 100, maybe, with all the guns from Corps, all the way to Corps. And they would all explode at one time. And it was devastating. I never saw anything like that in my life. And out of those 800 Germans, if a dozen of them lived, I do not believe it. I don't believe more than a dozen of them lived. The Red German Red Cross soldiers were picking the dead and wounded out for 3 days. I assume most of them were dead. But they got this barrage for about a half an hour, and these 240 aerial bursts just cracked. The whole valley and hills would shake in the air, and you had all these shells exploding at one time. And the Germans, just you could see them laying all over dead, and then we were firing at them with machine guns and the mortars, throwing mortar shells on them. And a few of them got down to the river, Saar River, and started swimming down river, and they got away. And we were machine gunning them into in the river. Some of them did get away, but I don't think more than a dozen of those 800 lived through that. It was absolutely fantastic in a way. It was tragic. But
when they were, the German Red Cross came into our, when our people came in, did we call a truce at that point?
No, they just, you can see it. You can see it. They have the armbands, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have the armbands, and they're regular soldiers. And they have litters, stretchers. You see them taking out any wounded. And
So you don't fire at them, just leave them do their business, and they let us, our Red Cross, do go down and like after a battle into an area where they're within easy shot of the Germans, and they don't bother. I've never seen any firing at Red Cross soldiers. Never. We never fired at them.
Okay.
And there, you had the zigzag trenches in the, it was a Siegfried Line area, and we moved up to another area after that, and a day later, and there was these old trenches then. I think some of them are from World War I yet, the old zigzag trenches, and we moved through there, and we went into another point of woods. But as we were going into this point of woods, we came across a body of German soldiers. There must have been 100 of them dead laying along the road there, just in a little small area. And here, one of our infantry companies that went ahead of us, were in there, and they caught these Germans coming down, marching into the road, on the road, and they didn't have any scouts out. So they deployed on either side of the road, and of course the Germans were all bunched up together, they weren't spread out, they didn't have any scouts out, and they opened fire on out of a German company, maybe 160 men. Well, they must have killed 100 of them laying dead on both sides of the road there. That's sort of a gruesome sight. And we went in a point of woods. This was parts of the Siegfried Line, and we had to go through shoe mine fields and to get there, and we were covered with German artillery and mortars. They fired on us, and we had to go through a small point to get to this point of woods, and small neck of land, like open, and where the road came, and it was all mined with shoe mines. And
what is a shoe mine?
It's just a little box, and if you just touch it with your foot, actually touch it, just even tap it, like it explodes, and you'll lose your foot. And we had some of the soldiers that accidentally stepped on them, and they lost their feet. Usually, they blow the foot right off. And but you had to step. You could see them lying on the ground. And then we had to, later on, we had the prisoners, German prisoners, and we had them. They flipped the lids on them, and that would deactivate them. Anyhow, we got down in this point of woods, and Germans found out we were there right away, and they, of course, threw in artillery on us, and that was the most terrible thing of being a soldier, the artillery barrages that you had to live through, and mortar. And then they attacked us there, and we had Tiger tanks this time. Germans used Tiger tanks on us, and they consider that area that we took was very vital to them for their defense. So they wanted it back, and they went through a lot of effort to try to get it back. We held the infantry, German infantry, off, and of course the German Tiger tanks couldn't go into the wooded area because of the trees. But they stayed out at the edge of the trees, and we held the German infantry off. But we had to eliminate the Tiger tanks, and they were firing at us. The German 88 shell was a deadly shell. It fired like a rifle. There was no trajectory to the shell. It was just a straight shot, like a rifle. And there were, an artillery gun has a trajectory arc. But the velocity of the 88, I think, was 3,300 feet per second, where a U.S. Army rifle, 3006 or 30, Garand M1 was 2,900. So you can imagine how fast a bullet travels. You just had time to jump in your fox or something. You hear the shot, you boom, bang, and then 1 second later, the shell was there on you. And where artillery would take longer, you had a few seconds to dive in the hole. So if you weren't on the alert and heard that gun go off, the chances are, you could lose your life quickly.
How deep did your foxhole have to be for you to be safe?
Well, it was usually about chest high, about chest high. So you could stand up in it and fire out, maybe neck high at times. Usually you dug it yourself. You had a little shovel, had a dug, and I must have dug 100 of them through my time in New York. And it was either you dig it or you die, because the shells hitting the ground throw shrapnel. And if you weren't protected by earth, why, chances are very, very good you wouldn't last long at all. And tree bursts is another thing. The shrapnel, of course, would rain down. The shell would strike a tree branch or tree trunk, and that was deadly. And it would just rain down on you. And a lot of soldiers died from artillery fire, a lot of them, a lot of casualties. And then I must say that 90% of the dead of World War II were infantry, if you look at your government statistics. So I was in a place where you died. It's the only way. You either die or wounded. It's the only way you get out of it. And this was in the Siegfried Line that we're still in, and we moved to another area, and we didn't do too much attacking. The Germans were doing attacking, mostly, and but we were jockeying back and forth is what we were doing. We were attacking with tanks and a few infantry companies, and then the Germans would counterattack, and it seemed like we were always pushing forward. We were taking land and driving the Germans back, and then we moved up along that Saar River, and then by Saarbrücken, I could see Generals Patton's 7th Division attacking the Germans up along this great big hill that over fronts Saarbrücken. And General Patton doesn't say anything about this 7th Division, except he used it as a reserve occupation division. But he pushed that division for 2 months trying to take a frontal Saarbrücken by a frontal assault, and his losses were so devastating that he had to pull that division out of line and would never fight again. But it was a new division, and he just kept pouring replacements in it, but he figured he could take Metz, he could take Saarbrücken, and it didn't turn out. And I hate to think how many American soldiers are dead for that disaster that took place there. And I would watch them soldiers attacking, and you could see them falling. And I had binoculars, and I could even see better than you can with the naked eye. And he did this for 2 months, trying to do it, and it was impossible. It was one of the strongest fortified sections in Siegfried Line. Well, then came March 15th. That's the Patton was already moving down through the Moselle Valley. He was getting ready to go down there and cut the Germans off behind the Siegfried Line, which he did. And March 15th was the big 7th Army push on the whole 60-mile front. I got a map of it here. It's down in here, anyhow. The whole 7th Army, you can't see it there. I don't have the regular Army border map. Anyhow, our job was to go 2 miles behind the German lines. We went very night, so we had a big artillery bombardment, very, very severe. And there was a little town of Fischingen, and that we were supposed to go through. And of course, the artillery from Kor all the way up just devastated. They stunned this whole area, the German area, and the Germans were so stunned by the artillery bombardment that they wouldn't even try to think of staving you off, you know, giving you a defense. So it was no problem just to go right through the German line at that time. And then we had other units going, other battalions, and they would swing their fire to another village or wooded area or open field and devastate that area, and that column would go through. And we were all sending columns down through the German lines, and we were had gone down 2 miles. 2 miles on a knoll, and we dug in on a knoll. And an interesting thing happened here on this day. We got replacements in. This is a true story. This actually, I experienced this. We had a replacement in, and I had this soldier in my squad, and he was down in the dumps. He was sullen, and he was almost in tears. And of course, replacements, they're scared. But he was really sad, and so I went to talk to him, and I told him he'll be a veteran pretty quick, and won't pass off. And he says, "I'm going to tell you something." And so I lend an ear, and he says, "I had a dream last night." And he says, "I dreamt my family had a party for me." Out of my head, he says, "But I had another dream like that, only the party was for my brother." And the next day, my family got a telegram, my brother got killed in the war. Only this time, the party was for me. And so he was afraid of that. And you know, when we went up on the knoll, 2 miles behind that German lines, the next day that boy was dead. Artillery shell came on his foxhole and killed him. And that actually is true. So, he was dead within less than 24 hours after he came in. Yeah. I don't know who I can't remember his name, but it's probably, find it through Army records that he got killed in the company. Yeah. But anyhow, that the big offensive worked, and the Germans just collapsed. The front just collapsed. They were in turmoil, and the Patton was in the rear and coming through the rear, and he cut them off, and the whole Saar area collapsed there. So the war, German surrender there, and the war came to a conclusion in the Siegfried Line area, in the Saar Palatinate, they call it. And we just occupied the Sanenberg, I remember staying in that town, Homburg. And we occupied those towns. And
did you find the Germans had much motorized equipment? Now, you talked about the Tiger tank. Did you see a lot of motorized equipment with them?
Oh, they had, yeah, they had a lot. They had quite a bit. Not as much as we did, but they had quite a bit. In fact, there are in the Saar there, and they were retreating there after Patton cut them off from the rear, and they were calling for miles and miles that they were shot up with the Air Force fighter planes that shot up columns that wind up around Zweibrücken, I think it was. There was one, I think about 6 miles long, German motorized column that was shot up by the Air Force fighter planes. You know.
Did you have a chance to go through and look at the Siegfried Line after you had taken it?
Well, I didn't go down into their big bunkers, no. We crossed the Dragon's Teeth, and then there were these smaller bunkers, and there were numerous, of course. And you'd look into them, and they usually had a little vent stack out of them, and they had the slits where you could fire your machine guns at you. But I didn't go into their major fortifications. They had them in their underground tunnels, and I didn't see any of that, no. I didn't have time, or it wasn't available to me. Mm-hmm. If I knew about it, I'd probably have gone, but it just wasn't accessible to me. I couldn't venture away from my area to go look at something.
The towns that you occupied, how did the German people treat you?
Good. Of course, they were subservient to us. That's the way they say obsequious. You could say that. Yeah. Because we were the masters then, you know. The soldier had the rifle and he was the master. And, so they treated us good. Really seldom do we have trouble from the civilians.
Did Did you have any personal contact with some of the civilians?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we talked to them. Yeah, we talked to them. We stayed in their houses, in their villages, you know. Yeah, had a lot of contact with Germans.
What did you talk about?
Well, we talked about the war, and they would say how futile it was, you know, and they agreed with us. But I look back and I think, well, like when France fell, you know, how they cheered because France fell, and they were really elated, and they should have cried right along with the French, really. But now they dance a different tune because the shoe's on the other foot, see? Yeah. But they were good to us. They even helped us. We wanted something, they helped us to a certain extent.
Did you ever pick up any souvenirs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've got souvenirs. Yeah.
What did you bring back?
Well, I brought in Heidelberg, I went in the Gestapo headquarters, and I got some Nazi armbands and a swastika flag that they fly off of a tank. And I brought a sword, German old sword back, Alles für Deutschland sword. And I haven't loaned out now, I've got to get it back. Have it with me here, and medals. I've got medals, German Iron Crosses, and Purple Heart. And my boy has them somewhere in a box upstairs. I can show them. I'll show them to you after a while.
Okay.
Yeah. And I got a German army uniform hat, but I could only carry what you could carry on your person, on body, because I had no bag. Infantrymen can't carry a bag, and I had a 42-pound mortar to carry, 42 pounds it weighed, and of course all the accoutrements with it, you know, the mortar sight, and you had the I had binoculars, and so you could watch your shell, and you had trenching shovel. Yeah, I had a trench knife, that's a 45 pistol. I carry that. That came with the mortar because I'm carrying a mortar, I can't carry a rifle, so they give me a pistol to carry a 45, and a machine gunner carried a pistol also. And you had these heavy weapons while you had a sidearm, they call it, 45. And the canteen, of course, Army fuel jacket, you had your K rations that fit in there, and they had grenades, and usually grenades were through the buttonholes, and we would take friction tape, and we'd take the safety pin on. Not safety pin, but the lever. When you pull the safety pin, there's a little lever on the grenade that flies off. And so you hold that lever when you pull the safety pin. But we usually didn't trust the safety pin, so we put one or two rounds of tape on it. Then if you wanted to throw the grenade, then you just tore the friction tape real fast, because we're carrying these grenades, some of them in our pockets, and usually carried a white phosphorus grenade and a shrapnel grenade. I usually carry two, and more were accessible all the time if you needed more. If you needed a whole box, the jeep or somebody to go down the back and bring up a whole box of grenades if you needed them. But usually the riflemen, they carried maybe half a dozen grenades of them. Because I had to carry the mortar, and then I had ammo bearers that carried mortar ammunition. They usually carry about 16 rounds or something.
How many pounds of equipment do you suppose you had on you?
Oh, quite a bit. Then they had a raincoat tied to your cartridge belt. Of course, the helmet was heavy, about 3 pounds. It wasn't as burdensome as you would think, but the mortar, you know, is heavy, 42. And I carry that quite a ways. And I grew up on a farm and I was tough. When I was young, I was tough. And that was no burden for me, really. I could carry that thing all day long and then get tired of changing. And I would chain shoulder to shoulder and no problem for me, really. Or some of the city fellas that weren't hardened as I was muscularly, it was a little harder for them to do that, carry that thing around. But I grew up hard work on a farm. It was easy for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, from where'd you go
from
there?
Well, by that time, Patton put up a bridge at Worms, and we got on trucks, and we drove over the Rhine River. We went into Mannheim, and it was devastated. There wasn't a house left standing. It was all rubble, the whole greater area of Mannheim even. And then we went to Heidelberg. We had to occupy Heidelberg. And my company had the duty to occupy the downtown section. And we had another company was supposed to occupy the university area and the hospital area, which is upriver from the Neckar. So we got into the castle side, detrucked castle side, and the Germans declared Heidelberg open city. It wasn't bombed, and there weren't that many soldiers around. They were retreating, of course, and there weren't that many soldiers around Heidelberg area, so I figured it was easy going, and kind of relieved. We didn't have to face the enemy at bay all the time, you know. And they had the old stone, 14th century stone bridge. And from the main proper medieval Heidelberg city, you crossed that stone bridge, and then the old castle was on the other side of the Neckar River. The Neckar is quite wide. It's about as wide as the Ohio River at least Liverpool. It's quite wide. And because in a few miles down, it flows into the Rhine. And so this is, Heidelberg is quite a ways downriver on the Neckar, quite a ways. And then they had, I remember this row of mansions. It was, beautiful, beautiful homes, mammoth homes, and all ornate. And the elite of Heidelberg lived there. And I remember going into those mansions, and I had my first real bath in 2 months. And I remember taking a cold bath and this long tub, and it must have been 8 feet long, and boy, I lived in luxury. I really felt good. And then the owners, the people that owned the place, they were very nice to us, and of course we were the masters, and we just looked around all we wanted anyhow. But they were.
Let's mention that one. All right, we are on site. We are on site two of the tape now. The Germans that you came in contact with, did many of them speak English?
Oh, yes. Quite a few. They learned this language, and English language, from the first grade they teach it in school. You know? And I'd say quite a few of them. And they spoke good English, good, correct English, better than the Americans speak. Yeah. You know? They pronounced every word correctly, and there was no slang talk, of course. They didn't say words like ain't. We do. Colloquialism. Well, we were supposed to get across the Neckar River and occupy downtown Heidelberg, but the stone bridge has been blown, and the middle sections inside the river is missing, and the Germans are wailing because their beautiful bridge is gone. And the German army blew it up, or Hitler ordered it blown up, and I can't remember what it was. And all I heard was wail from the Germans because their beautiful bridge is gone. But the pier sections were still there, and they've repaired it, rebuilt it. I can't even tell it that it's since after the war. Anyhow, but the only way to get across the river there was on a rowboat. They had a trench running down from the old stone bridge along the Neckar, and so we got down in the trench area along the shore, and some of the men went over on rowboats, and I got on the rowboat with three other men, four to a boat, and we started out from shore, and this Messerschmitt came overhead, and German Messerschmitt fire plane, and he spotted us on the lake, and he spotted us in the trench there. and the whole column of most of the company. Well, there was about 180 men to a company, and so there must have been only a few boats went over, so there must have been 150 of us laying in the trench area, and some of them were outside, they walking around on the shore. Anyhow, we spotted the Messerschmitt, and I hollered, "Let's get back to the trench, men, fast!" And we paddled that boat fast, and we could see the Messerschmitt art turning, and down he comes at us, and we got to the shore, and we just dived in the trench, and he sprayed the whole area. And he must have not have taken a good aim, because nobody got killed or wounded. And he sprayed that whole area, and I think he had about 8 machine guns firing at us out of that Messerschmitt. And then he took off, flew off, and we didn't see him anymore. So we got on the boat and we rode into Heidelberg, and the whole company got over. And I was right downtown Heidelberg, right in the main heart of the city my company occupied. And I remember going into the, walking into Hotel Schroeder, which was their Waldorf Astoria there, and going in the lobby and looking around to see if we could find any Germans, but soldiers, but there was just civilians, and they were going about their business, and they were quite busy. And the street sidewalks were plentiful, and of course there were no automobiles moving or anything like that, street cars, but there were just numerous people walking around. You see nurses and people in some kind of a uniform, servile work, and the hotel lobby was busy, and they were going about their business, just kind of ignoring us, and we weren't bothering them. But up on top of the hill, Heidelberg is about 600 foot elevation, and the Germans were up there sniping at us. They were shooting, of course. They weren't trying to kill us, really, because no one got hit. I think they were just trying to harass us, because the civilians were right amongst us, and I guess they didn't want to make sure they didn't kill any German civilians. But we had orders to flush them out, go up and flush them out. But we stayed in Heidelberg that night, and I think we stayed in an opera house, but I'm not sure. But it was a big hall, like, I remember, and it was on the main road there along the base of the hill there, and beautiful, it's a beautiful city, beautiful, and beautiful architecture, and the old homes and buildings, beautiful. Of course, there weren't too many homes there, outside apartments. They were all stores and buildings, and so we stayed in this, I think it was an opera house, but I can't remember. Anyhow, we had to go up this winding road that goes up to the Hotel Schloss and past it. And this Hotel Schloss today is the 7th Army, U.S. Army headquarters. And it's a very beautiful big hotel up on top of the hill. Like, and there's an elevator that runs from the base, the hill, all the way up. And that's the way you get up there. So you don't have to take the winding road up. But we had to march up this winding road. And it was tedious, it was hard, and I carried a 42-pound mortar up this hill, and it's like trying to climb a mountain, only the pathway was smooth, and it took us a couple of hours to get up to the top, and we got up to the top. We didn't go into the Hotel Schloss, and we just kept on going, and I never did get to go inside of the building, and this is the building that Mark Twain stayed in. Remember I was telling you on the telephone. He stayed at this Hotel Schloss for a couple months, and he wrote a book. I have it over here, Tramp Abroad. And he mentioned staying there. I have one of them marked. It's right in here. I can't find it now, but his book, here it is, Tramp Abroad, right here. He mentions about staying at this Hotel Schloss. And I'll find it for you later in there. Anyhow, we and he took walks around this wooded area. Road winds down to another little German town, right over the crest of the hill, and it's all wooded, forested And Mark Twain writes about walking every morning, listening to birds singing, and taking strolls. And of course, I think he was down in this little village too. This is only about maybe a kilometer. It was about a half a mile, 6/10. And the Germans ran into this little village, and so we got to the edge of the town, and I was throwing mortar shells in, and I think that's the first actual firing the Heidelbergers ever heard, artillery firing or mortar fire, within earshot of them. And the two of us were, no, three, we had the three mortars firing at the Germans. There we could see them in the streets there in the little village. And then we called for artillery fire, and artillery sent in shells, and houses were burning, and Germans started running out of the village into the open area in the road and the fields. They were running away, and of course we was throwing the mortar shells right on them. And as they advanced, we were just one shell after another was thrown down and expending all our ammunition on them. And they surrendered. We took about 90 prisoners. 90. And so one of the soldiers goes down in the schoolhouse cellar. This is where they find all the liquors. All the best liquors of Europe is in the schoolhouse cellar. And it's just all this cognac and the champagne, wines, the Rhine, the Moselle, you know, the best that Europe has to offer. It was all in there. And so the general heard about it, and he says, we're going to have a feast with that after the war is over. And he kept his word. And it took four army trucks to haul that out, 4 6x6 army trucks. So he gave the division three trucks, and he commandeered one truck for officers, exclusive use, which was all right with us. And he kept his word, and after the war, we had our little gas houses, which was like a little beer garden, and wherever town we stayed in, and they just kept supplying the thing with, and you just went in there, and you had all you wanted, all the Rhine wine, you wanted champagne, just ask, give me the Hennessy cognac, you know, or Hennessy, you know, whatever you wanted, and the bartender would bring out the whole bottle, he'd set it right on the table for you, and you could have all you want. And some of the fellas drank heavily, and I didn't. I would sample it every once in a while. So he didn't have to pay for any of it. It was all there, available for it. And anyhow, the next day was Easter Sunday, and by that time, everybody, half the company's drunk. So we stayed in the town that night, see? And we had to keep chasing the Germans. He says, Captain's hollering, he says, we got to keep flushing the Germans, and over the hills and through and across the streams, and beautiful country, beautiful country. And you have this church with the steeple, and you have a medieval castle, you know, and a picturesque town in the valley, and one up on a hill, and it's rolling hilly country. I think it was Württemberg. There it was Württemberg, and we got into Bavaria and Baden, and southern Germany is beautiful, beautiful, breathtaking, breathtaking. It's a beautiful place, and we started out, and soldiers can't go. They kept dropping out, and they won't go, and the captain's swearing in his typical soldier vocabulary, and he's calling us all kind of names, and he says, you fellas throw those cognac, champagne bottles, wine bottles away. I don't want to see one. I'm going to court-martial every one I catch. And he's, all I want to see is ammunition on you. So the fellas, they had it thrown down, and we couldn't go anyhow because too many fellas were inebriated, and they just had to sleep it off. So the captain, he called army trucks out, and they hauled us to some little village in the valley, nestled in the valley, and sort of secure, and he says, you fellas sleep it off.
And of course, I think he grinned kind of on a, you know, side grin, you know, don't let it happen again. And because we were a good company, and my company, I would say, suffered the most dead and the most casually wounded in the whole division. So we were always spearheading for the battalion. Anytime there was an attack, usually my company did the attacking, usually spearheaded. And we did the hardest work. And the captain wasn't afraid to tackle anything, no matter how severe it was. My men will do it. We'll take care of it. And so...
Who was your captain?
His name was Angelo Pilla. He was from Boston. He was severe, very severe captain. Very severe, strictly business. And he didn't talk to the men hardly at all. There was very little communication, strictly army communications, but there was no just a buddy-buddy, you know, getting commandeery, getting friendly, patting on the back, none of that at all. Yes, sir, not with him. And he was the extreme the other way. And then you had the friendly captains, you know, they would pat you on the back, commandeery, and the guys, he's such a good Joe, you know, you'd do anything for him, you know. And you had that kind of a captain, which is the kind I would like. But it wasn't my way. And I had this severe captain, and the men were actually afraid of him, you know. He always threatened court-martial, and he wasn't too well-liked. He wasn't well-liked. And he got shot in the throat, and I'll tell you about it in another battle here after... it's coming up here. It's on the next battle here we had. And so we're flushing the Germans and through the woods after we spent the night sleeping it off. And we figure things are going pretty good, and we get up here towards Heilbronn up area, and what do we run into? The 17th SS Panzer Division. And they were tough. And they were at full strength with young recruits. And this was the division that I think 17th spearheaded the Hitler's drive into Russia. And it was a tough outfit, and it was one of the best known divisions in the whole German army. And when they wanted something done, they would call the 17th SS, and we ran right into them. And we spent 5 days with them, and it was terrible. It was a hard battle. I mean, there was just continuous shelling and firefighting and jockeying around, shooting at each other. And I remember we had a severe battle for 3 days, and then they pulled us off, and the next day we went to attack the Germans at Stein, just about a mile from where we had been with them for 3 days, and I was exhausted. I was never so tired. And we spent the night at the rear and to attack in the morning. The captain told us we were going to attack the German. This is the SS troopers, and of course they had Tiger tanks, but they were on the defensive. They were holding to stop us from advancing. And they weren't trying to advance. And so in the bright and early in the morning, we attack. And we were supposed to have an artillery barrage on the Germans, and we didn't get any. And the whole company's walking through this big wheat field, and we got caught in a crossfire with machine guns, German machine guns. And it was tragic. The whole company's almost wiped out, the whole company. 33 men left. That's all we had left in a half an hour. And we're going in single file as my mortar squad, and the boy in front of me is dead.
the boy behind me is dead. He dropped, and the bullets are spraying around my feet. And I'm running, we're running. And then I see these bullets spraying around my feet, and one goes through my pant leg, one goes through my canteen, one goes through the border base plate, and none went through me, luckily. But I hit the ground, and I just played dead, like I got hit. And the first fellow in front of me dropped. He's dead, and the fellow behind me's dead, and then a couple more soldiers ahead of me, that soldier's dead. But I lay there about a minute, and all acts of bravery, all kind of acts of bravery. There should have been a lot of silver stars given out, and they only gave out one. But anyhow, there were four German machine guns, and German machine guns, they fire fast, rapid fire. They go brr, brr, brr. Where American machine guns go bub, 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 slow fire. And the Germans can spray an area, but they're not that accurate, see. That's probably one of the reasons I'm still alive, because he sprayed at me, he was firing right at me, see. He sprayed me, and the bullet you could see him just hitting the ground, brrr, digging up the dirt in the wheat field. Brrr, like that, it's all around me. And I lay down on the ground, and he shifted his fire to rifle platoon, and he pinned them down, and three of the machine guns got eliminated by bravery, and the German riflemen were over a crest of the hill, and these four advanced machine gunners were supposed to hold us at bay or devastate us, so very few of us could get over the top. But there were more Germans right over the crest of the hill, and a machine gun was firing at the rifle platoon. He's picking the fellas off. They hit the ground. He had them all laying down, 30 men. They hit the ground because they couldn't advance the suicide, so they laid on the ground and tried to survive as they could. And the German was shifting his fire on them, and he's firing at them. And in the meantime, I could see the German machine gun, and they had an assistant gunner that was feeding the belt in. And he wasn't that far away from me. I got up and ran into a little dip like in the ground, and I was on my knees, and I put the mortar up. I didn't take my gun sight out, and I just dead reckoning firing. So I dropped one shell down in mortar, and it went over. Well, I corrected the adjustment. I dropped the other shell in right by the foxhole. It went off, and the two Germans died just like that. And so I hauled the platoon up. I says, "Let's go, men." "Okay." And then they came up and went over the crest. In the meantime, some of the other riflemen were eliminating them. And the way you usually eliminate a string of riflemen, especially enemy in a hole, foxhole, is take a machine gun and you fire over the foxhole. And because nobody's going to stick their head out of a hole if the machine gun bullets are flying over his, so you can stay right in the hole. And so you lay down a base of fire over the hole, and a rifleman comes up with a grenade. Sometimes they crawl, other times they creep on knees, and they throw the grenades in the foxholes, and one after the other. And you go right down the line, and you eliminate the whole line, and that's the way it's done. And so they eliminated a lot of them Germans, and these were tough SS. They were tough. They were young, and they were tough, and they were big, and a lot of them died. And that battle lasted about a half an hour, and Germans, yeah, they stayed in Stein. That was Stein, Germany, and they retreated. What was left of them, they retreated into that town. And we took over a draw area, sort of like a road, and a dip in there, cutting the road, and we took over that area. But we cut out the road to make it level, the ground to make the road level. And so we stayed in there that night. But anyhow, after the battle, we only had 33 men left. And my sergeant, our sergeant, I had a buck sergeant, he was the company commander. And I was kind of despondent and disappointed, because we had a
regular master sergeant down at with headquarters. He was with the kitchen or something, and he never came up. And he couldn't lead them in anyhow because he was more administrative. And they didn't send anybody to oversee us. So we just took over. We didn't have any officers left. All our officers were killed or wounded. And the captain was shot in the throat. And I saw him going back, holding his throat. He was walking back to the rear, and holding his throat. He was shot, had a bullet hole. And I don't know how he came through, whether he lost his voice. And I did hear, after the war, I heard that he lost his voice. I don't know.
Who got the Silver Star?
A boy by Clarence Garrity. He took over the company, and he did a very good job. And he commanded the company. He was just a buck sergeant. He was a mortar man with like me, and he was the mortar section sergeant at that time. And his name was Clarence Garrity, and he was from Detroit. And real nice fella. After the war, they gave him a Silver Star. We had a little battalion parade for him. And there should have been a lot more that got the star besides him. But what he did was very good.
What did he do?
Well, he actually advanced on Germans, and he eliminated them in the foxholes, and I think he took over the machine gun. I didn't see this part because he had gone over the crest of the hill, and I was firing at this other German machine gun with my mortar, and I was busy with that job. And in the meantime, all this happened, and that he had taken over and eliminated these Germans. I think he took over a machine gun the fellow got killed on, and he fired it at the Germans. And I think he just actually walked up along the foxholes and was shooting into them and killing the Germans. Just acts of bravery It's amazing that he lived through it. Amazing. And the SS were tough. They were good fighters. You didn't play around with them. It was just no kid stuff. And but he was the only one that got a medal in that whole battle. The only one. And then we got a lot of replacements in the next 2 days, I think. We got another 150 men or something. There was only 33 men left in the company. We got replacements in, I think, in about 2 days. And then then after about this 5 day battle, why the 17th SS was eliminated, you can see this arrow in the book, it says it's crushed. So that ended all the resistance. And from here, it was easy going. We went down through towns and through Bavaria and Wurttemberg and Baden, I think, and down to the Rhine River, Danube River. Gunzburg on the Danube is where we crossed. There was a bridge there. It was blown, but it was still standing like the Remagen. We crossed over there, and it was between Ulm and I can't think of the other town. Anyhow, it was near Ulm, and the German Autobahn goes right near it now. Well, it did then too. It was down into Munich. And so we went to the outskirts of Munich. We got on trucks, and we captured Gunzburg. I remember taking that, and that wasn't much of a job. We crossed the bridge on foot, and we had a little bit of firefight. And the Germans all surrendered, and some of them ran to the next town, and we had to go in the next town to get them. And then we got on trucks, and we went all the way down to the Danube River, I think it's here at Gunzburg. I'll show you a little map. I don't know. Let me take, stay idle. I'm gonna hold up the tape too long.
That's okay, I've got plenty of tape.
Well, here's the Danube. This is Austria. I just can't find it right here.
Yeah. Here's Günzburg that you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, that's it, Günzburg. Yeah. And, yeah, that's where we crossed the Danube. And then we got on trucks, we went to Landsberg.
I don't know, yeah, Landsberg, all right.
We were at Landsberg, and there's the German concentration camp, the famous Landsberg concentration camp. All right, we have an armored division with tanks, and of course our infantry are on trucks, and some are riding on the tanks, and some are riding on scout cars and half tracks, whatever you could ride on. And we rode in the whole column is moving as one, as a convoy, and we're just going and going. It was easy, and there was no resistance, just like driving down these roads here today. Nothing to stop you. And we got into Landsberg, and there's this concentration camp, and we're right there, and we take all these SS, the guards, and the officers, we take them prisoner. And the prisoners were all in striped suits, little shirt and pants, and they have oats in their pocket. And they're all emaciated, and bony, and nothing to eat. And pulls his oats out of his pocket, and he says, in broken English, he says, "This is what we eat: oats that you feed a horse." And that's all they ate. And of course, they probably cooked it maybe a little bit.
What kind of people were they?
They looked mostly Frenchmen. Most of them were French, surprisingly. I didn't see any that looked Jewish. They must have eliminated them already. And what they probably had there is the French resistance fighters in those, but most of them were French. And but they had others. And there were a few black Senegalese, I think, from the African French colonies. And I'd say 90% of them were French. And so we stayed there at Landsberg, and I'm in the Burgermeister's house. I didn't know it. I'm that's the mayor of Landsberg. And so when there's no activity, then you just look around and see what's around. So I look around out in the back, and there's some kind of a factory building in this backyard. And I look around more, and it's a cheese factory. And there's great big wheels of cheese are stacked in this cellar, and these poor prisoners from the Landsberg concentration camp, and they're starved. We gave them all their K rations and cigarettes, and they're still hungry, and I'm calling them over, and I said, come here, and they're carting out these great big wheels of cheese. They're just carting them out like ants taking, you know, a colony of ants, and they're coming the whole concentration camp is coming over. And of course we opened the gates, and they just infiltrated into the town and on the roads, and they were just didn't know what to do. They were just waiting for some authority to tell them what to do and feed them and send them back home or something. They were happy because they were free at last, but they were carting these big wheels of cheese out, and I was glad that they had something to eat. So this Burgermeister comes to me, because at that time I had advanced to mortar section sergeant, acting mortar section sergeant. I was the head of the mortar section at that time. He wanted to know who the abandoned authority was, and they sent him, a soldier sent him to me, and he gives me this bill for his cheese. And I was really stunned. The audacity of that man to ask me to pay for his cheese to feed them poor, starving people. And that was exactly the attitude of those SS, police that watched them. And they could see they had ingrained even him, you know, to think exactly like they think. And you'd think he would be grateful that he's alive and his home is safe he survived, and what's a few wheels of cheese that he had in the cellar, even 100 wheels, So it's trivial. And here he's worried about his bill, his cheese money. So he had, so Katz was there, he was from Coyville, Kansas, and he was the machine, one of the machine gunners. And he must have had 30, 40 Germans to his credit. And if he had notches on that gun, it would be, I figure minimum 30, maybe. It might have gone up to 80, because I wasn't with him all the time. And but in 5 months on the front line, why, he had quite a few Germans to his credit. And he was tough. He was a farm boy, and he was tough. He was young, like me, at that time. And wasn't a big man. He was a little bit, about an inch taller than I was. But he was tough. And I was telling Katz, I says, this is the Burgomaster, what's paid for that cheese? And he was furious. He pulls out his trench knife, and he grabs his German by the hair, and he sticks this trench knife at his throat, and he says, and the German thought he was going to kill him. You know? And Katz says, you got schnapps? Yeah, I got schnapps. And he says, you get schnapps, you know, in English. And of course, the German understood what he wanted. You know? He gets on his bicycle, and he's shaking, he's nervous, and he gets on his bicycle, and he pedals away. He's back a few minutes later with his bottle of schnapps. And Katz, he liked a little bit of schnapps now and then. And I hated that stuff. It was terrible. And anyhow, that ended that. That German never will mention that bill again, you know. He actually had a piece of paper with so many wheels of cheese written on it, and so many marks that he wanted for it. It's sort of a invoice, you know. And he gave me that. Probably that's something that he did business with, you know, as he sold. And then we left there. Oh, that's where we got relieved. I think we got relieved by the 36th Texas Division relieved us. And this is the outskirts of No. We did go to the, I think, the Isar River from there, Landsberg. And the 36th Texas Division relieved us. And they were supposed to go, which they did, into Austria, past Birch's Garden and this Garmisch-Partenkirchen, you know, the resort area, which I didn't get to see. And the Austria, Linz, I think, they went as far as Linz. And but this was 10 days before the war ended. And I was grateful to be relieved because I read stories of dying the last day of the war, you know, and I didn't want that to happen to me. And so 10 days before the war ended, we pulled back here to, we went to a little town of Kunzelsau. Very pretty, pretty country. And it was Bad Mergentheim there in Wertheim on the Tauber River, and it flowed down into the Mainz River where Würzburg was. And it's beautiful country, beautiful country. Not too far from Heidelberg. It was an upriver from Heidelberg. It was on a different river, Tauber. And I think it was Württemberg, they call that area. Beautiful country. And we just stayed as occupation duty. But anyhow, the last 3 days of the war, I was in Paris. And the day the war ended, I was in Paris. And I had to go back to Germany then, back home to Kunzelsau. And I had to leave Paris that day. But I was there, and they had the snake dances, and of course Paris went wild. Went wild. And the American soldiers that were in Paris just joined the French, and they were snake dancing in the streets. And they had the parades, I think, the following day. I missed the big army parades and soldier parades. They had the French army parading and the Americans parading. And I missed all that formal parade. But all they had on the day of the war May 8th was the snake dancing. And of course, crowds, the Place de la Opera, the square in Paris was just jammed with people, millions. They were all in the, and all the Champs-Élysées, that was all shoulder to shoulder, and snake dancing, and we're pushing the people aside so they could snake dance, and they would hold hands. And I remember sitting up on the opera house at the
where they had the Claude Rains and this Phantom of the Opera, you know, where it took place in that opera house. I remember sitting up on the steps up there, climbed the steps and sat on the side. They had some ornate figures around there, I can't remember right. I sat there for about an hour just watching this Frenchman dancing in the streets in relation that the war was over. Then later that afternoon, I had to go to the Gardel, I think it was Gardel Est, that was a railroad station for going west. Or going east, yeah, Gardel Est, going east. I had to take the train to Saarburg, I think. And I remember passing through Chateau Thierry, the World War One fame, and Barley Duck, and you could still see the trenches from World War One. And you can still see even the bunkers or towers that they used, observation towers. Some of that was there left from World War One yet. It was amazing. I was amazed that this would still be around. And you could see trenches that they never bothered filling in from World War One. The Barley Duck there. And even at where we detrained at when we're coming up in the Alsace on the 48s, I remember in Looneyville, and that was World War One area, and there were a lot of trenches there yet from World War One. I remember seeing that. Yeah. And that was it. Then the war ended. That was it. We stayed in there in Germany, and we moved around to different towns, and I got to go to Brussels. I was in Bastogne after the war. I remember going through Bastogne and all the tanks and all the devastation of the battles was still there. Nobody had picked up anything. German tanks and American tanks that were knocked out, and cannons, and artillery guns, trucks overturned. There was all laying there. And I remember going through Bastogne after the war. But I never did get up into the Bulge area. During the wars,
yeah.
But then I stayed there for occupation duty, and the officer wanted me to go on through the IQs, and I had enough to go to officer's candidate school, the IQ, and I never did get the opportunity. They never asked me to go, and but he wanted me to go to West Point Military Academy, and I said, no, I don't want to go. I want to go home. He said, we'll take care of your, I says, I can't pass the test now. I'm mentally unstable, you know, I'm exhausted. He says, we'll take care of that. You want to go, we want combat infantry men to go to West Point. I had a cadet, I had to start out as a freshman, of course. And that was one of the greatest things I desired when I was a child, youth. I wanted to go to West Point. And come the opportunity, I didn't want to go. I turned it down. I says, no, I don't want to go. I want to go home. I'm physically, mentally exhausted. I just cannot tolerate four more years of, especially what the Army would call chicken, you know, trivial discipline, you know. Everything spick and span, and everything shoes had to be polished, and everything, and it can't be one little speck of dust anywhere. And so I was too tired for that. I had grown up. See, I had become of age, and even when I came home, it took me years to get adjusted, to settle down. It was mentally, and I'd have nightmares, and I still have nightmares sometimes. And war is a terrible, terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing. It's one of the worst things a man could face outside of physical torture. And you don't realize this until it happens to you. It's so horrible. It's such a horrible thing. You're alive, and the next day you're dead. That's it for you. And you see your friends. It's gone. And my company lost maybe 80 dead, and I don't know how many wounded. I think we lost the most dead in the division. And there's a lot of men. And we were in a lot of hard battles, all artillery barrages. And let's say, talking about artillery, our artillery was deadly artillery. We used good ammunition and good steel. And I had a German soldier tell me after the war, and he had lived for 8 years in all the wars and survived. And he said, there's nothing more deadlier than American artillery. That's the most deadliest thing you'd ever want to experience, he says. He says, I'm telling you because it happened to me. He says, there's nothing more deadlier than American artillery. You get an American artillery barrage, it's so powerful. And the shrapnel just shreds all over. And it is. Even a mortar shell goes off. It's deadly. It's powerful. Very powerful. That's about it.
Okay.
That's all I can think of. I have other... I could probably talk more, but I think I've covered my 5 months of the war, or my army life, or what's that word? Posterity. All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right.